at the UFO Retrieval Conference, Sunset Station in Las Vegas, with Sunset Station Hotel and Casino, Peter Robbins. Your special is going to be on December 12th. I call it your special. You actually worked pretty closely in it.
I did, but it's certainly the Sci-Fi Channel special. The Bentwaters UFO incident, also known as the Rendlesham Forest incident, although regarded very highly around the world, is not the best-known case to Americans, although I think it's at least as important as Roswell. And we finally have, for the first time, an American production company doing a feature documentary on it. There have probably been 15 or so pieces done in England and Europe over the past years. But this one, I think, will be absolutely terrific, and we're all looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, it's on December 12th, the first time around, I think, at 9 o'clock Eastern, probably.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And, you know, when they shoot these documentaries, and you've done a lot of these, some you have control of, some you don't, and I guess you might have been a little concerned about what Sci-Fi Channel was going to do, but I understand you're fairly happy with the product.
I am, and I'm very pleased with the Sci-Fi Channel's kind of ethical approach to this. They are certainly understanding that this is a serious subject and that it kind of complements their mandate to show science fiction, but that sci in sci-fi is actually something that's appealing to them more and more. And so they have commissioned a number of good documentaries on the UFO situation, and ours is the latest in the series.
Now, you were involved in writing the book, and tell me a little bit about the whole incident.
Mm. What we're talking about was a series of UFO incidents that took place over three nights between Christmas and New Year's in 1980. They happened in and around two of our most secured NATO bases in southeastern England, RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge. And it was a series of UFO incursions, overpasses, landings, and ultimately a full-scale landing and a disembarkation by three presences witnessed by many Air Force personnel.
And as a result of that contact, I mean, what was said, if anything?
It's still very much a mystery. It really didn't get kept secret for a lot of years because my co-author, Larry Warren, who was an Air Force security police officer at the time, went public with this information a few years after, and the story broke because of the information that he put forward. I don't think there was any overt talking communication, but if it's true that 70 or 80% of all human communication is nonverbal, there definitely was communication. There was a face-off between human beings and non-human intelligences.
So they got out and then they got back in the ship and left, or what?
Not that mechanical. They sort of appeared outside of the ship, almost apparition-y, but there were three separate beings with, you know, definable features floating about the foot off the ground with their backs to the craft, and a cordon of American Air Force security personnel surrounding them, all disarmed, and ultimately an officer, we feel that it was at the time Colonel Gordon Williams, who stepped through the cordon and faced off with these beings. It was totally nonviolent, and it went on well into the evening until they seemed to have gone back in and the machine left.
And you don't know much about the communication of what actually happened.
Well, there was no talk. It was simply a face-off.
They just stared each other down.
Pretty much. That's the best descriptions I have had, yes.
And basically, one of the important things about this, I think, and maybe you can correct me because you know more about it than I do, wasn't this the height of the Cold War? Wasn't that a nuclear base?
Good question. Two important backstories. By virtue of our treaty with the UK in 1980, we were not supposed to have nuclear ordnance in England, and we had an awful lot of it stored at those two bases. Also, December 1980 was when the Gdansk shipyards in Poland were coming alive with the pro-democracy movement. What we didn't know was that at that time, at the end of December 1980, the Soviets had massed over 100,000 troops on the Polish border. This was not news item stuff. This was just high security. All the bases in NATO were on red alerts, red as one step below black, and black as war. And in fact, Bentwaters Woodbridge, their fighter aircraft were already at forward operating locations in West Germany, ready to fight if they had to. Obviously, it did not come to that, thank God.
Makes you wonder how the UFOs landed. I guess it just actually appeared.
Well, there were a number of, again, specific events. It began with UFOs coming in over the Twin Base complex. And, in fact, as dramatic as anything of these incidents was these beams of light that were fired down from these UFOs into the weapons storage area, and I mean the nuclear weapons storage area.
Did they disarm them?
I have heard from Colonel Charles Halt, who was the deputy base commander. He told Larry and I to our faces when we met him across the street from the Pentagon some years ago that those beams of light penetrated the hardened bunker, which would have been steel, earth, concrete, etc., and quote-unquote adversely affected the ordnance, which gives you a chill.
So no communication. They just stared at each other for a long time. The entities didn't literally get up and walk back to the craft. They just appeared. They appeared and then they disappeared.
That's my best understanding. That is my best understanding, yes.
Well, it's a pretty incredible story. We look forward to that that special. I understand the documentary really has some pretty good film graphics. They go back to where the things happened.
They really did it right. They brought back every witness that was willing to work on the project to the location. They interviewed a few researchers and writers, myself, Nick Pope of the Ministry of Defense, Nick Redfern, a wonderful British researcher, and Georgina Bruni, who wrote another book on the subject in the UK. Everyone else were the personalities that were involved in it. And they did some very appropriate recreations, nothing corny or silly. I just think they went about it in the right spirit, and they want this information to come out as well, and they want Americans to know about it.
Your book, is it still available?
Well, it is, but
is it out of print officially? Or?
Technically it is, although I think it's still available on Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com.
They look around for it.
We are hopeful that we'll have it out in a mass market paperback next year, though.
Well, yeah, it certainly should be a market for it, especially after the special. Now, you're here at the conference, the UFO Retrieval Conference, here in Las Vegas, Nevada, at the Sunset Hotel and Casino, and you had an interesting subject here.
Yeah, I veered off from my British UFO research work to come back to a very important project to me that I did some initial research on more than a dozen years ago. It is essentially a 54-year-old murder mystery and involves an extremely important American personality who's all but forgotten now, our first Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal.
Of course, we remember that name, but most people don't remember the controversy that that happened and whether or not it was a suicide.
Well, if we're to believe the official account, Forrestal had a profound nervous breakdown literally upon his retirement from that position in March of 1949, and was held at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland, and supposedly early in the morning of May 22, 1949, found his room door unlocked, went across the hall, kicked out a window, and jumped out the window. I feel I've been able to present information that were our audience upstairs a grand jury, they would have just cause to reopen this as a murder investigation.
You'd have an indictment, Counselor. You certainly would. Especially the way you lay out the case about the medical technician that night, not normally there.
Yeah, there were some dark doings, no question about it. Also that, if we're to believe the official account, he tried to hang himself out the window. Jumpers jump, people are going to hang themselves. He had his bathroom sash cord tied tightly around his neck and fingernail scratch marks on the window jamb. It's a Greek-level tragedy, and he was a remarkably decent man and somebody who left a tremendous impact on the middle of the 20th century and somebody who we need to know about again.
And you laid out in this conference the UFO connection, and it makes a lot of sense if you stop and think about it, because Roswell, 1947, and he was, head of the, he had a whole file cabinet full of secrets, you said.
Well, he kept a diary from the time he was Under Secretary of Navy in 1940, which he stopped doing a few months before he died. And by my best estimate, that diary, if that's the right word to use, could number close to 20,000 pages. The government allowed a small percentage of it to come out in a popular hardcover book in 1951, but that's the last we heard of it. There's no question that there is information that we will be going after over the next months with Freedom of Information Act requests, but it's, again, it's a terribly important human story and a very important political story that people need to know about.
And the interesting thing about it, from my perspective, is the fact that he may have been knocked off, but it wasn't by people who did not like him. He was just a mental illness at that point. He was had a problem, I guess, with knowing all these secrets, and they just didn't want to take a chance.
I think that's...
We're talking the Oliver Stone conspiracy theory here, but it's probably what happened.
Sometimes conspiracies happen, and the fact is here, this is 1949, psychoanalysis was really still rather radical to the American middle class, and as they say, you're going to see a psychiatrist, you've got to be crazy. They didn't know. He could say anything, and there was no question about the fact that he did suffer a nervous breakdown, tried to take his life, and then in treatment was getting better. But maybe too much better, and they had to finish the job for him. I know that may sound a little theatrical in this brief treatment we're doing here, but it is the goods. And I will be doing a more complex presentation on this in April 2004 in Washington, D.C. at the X Conference. So folks ought to mark that on their calendars.
Sounds like there might be a book here, too.
There might be. There well might be.
I'm trying to get him to commit to these things. like as I'm trying to get you to commit to things, Peter Robbins.
It's the first time a project has bitten me hard enough since I finished Left at East Gate that I am saying to myself, could stay with this for a book-length project or a film treatment. Again, it is a story very close to my heart. My mom was the one who got me interested in it after the MJ-12 documents came out in 87. She said, James Forrestal, he was somebody who really meant a lot to us during World War II, and I, like a lot of my teenage friends, had a crush on him. He was a handsome guy.
And he was rich.
Yes, he was. But he was rich in the self-made Great Gatsby mode.
He came from Wall Street, right?
Well, he came from upstate New York, a poor boy. But yes, he was on Wall Street at the height of the Depression doing just great until 1938 when Roosevelt asked him to join his brain trust for $1 a year. And he gave up everything, essentially, to go to Washington and be paid $1 a year to serve at the president.
For those $1 a year men. We need that back in government.
One exception, my mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, he's got billions, he's taking $1 a year. I like
you're right, and they should be doing that more often. So this is probably going to keep you busy right now, or do you have some other little project you can let us in on?
No, right now, this is the one that's bitten me, and this is the one I'm going to be working on.
Peter, it's always a pleasure reading your work and hearing about you and finally meeting you in person.
A real pleasure for me too, Jerry. I've been a fan for a long time.